Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Ellefson with the Digital Education Podcast. Opportunity, and I always think about this, I've taken a little bit of a break over the last month, big event in San Antonio, but just life, things happen. And so we slow down a little bit. But February is always that time where educators kind of get tired and worn out and sometimes distracted. And so we head into March and head into a new season. And I'm blessed to have two new friends with me, two people that I'm getting to know in this process. The first is Evan Willis. He's a researcher at UNC Charlotte and a Seventh-day Adventist pastor. His expertise and his research interests include equity and inclusion, the impact of race and religion on Christian schooling, Black male outcomes, and its function in both the Black community and in urban spaces. The other guest with us today is Stephanie Jones-Fosu. She's a researcher at UNC Charlotte. She's taught middle school and high school students for 9 years. She's also coached over 100 first and second year teachers through a non-traditional teaching organization. And then her interests, research interests include pre-service, teacher preparation, and culturally sustainable pedagogy. So Stephanie, I'm going to go to you first and jump right in. And both of you are in the urban education department at UNC Charlotte. Your interests are in urban education. I'm really interested, as you and Evan, as you research and study and work with urban educators and urban schools, like, what are the successes that we've seen in urban education over the last 20 years? And then how are we seeing urban education even change, right, you know, amidst the work that you're doing right now?
Right, right. Well, great question, Eric, and thank you for having us on. So first, I want to just clarify like what urban means, especially when we think about what it means in education. And so Milner, back in 2012, kind of came up with a definition for urban education, just urban in general, when we think about putting in the right context. And so it's based on population. So there's like three different categories of urban. There's urban characteristic, which is more so schools that aren't really close to a big city, but they're beginning to start seeing increases of urban kind of characteristics, whether it's increased the numbers of bilingual individuals where English is not their first language. And then you get to like urban emergent, which is basically a larger city. It's not huge, but these are, you know, a lot of them have, you know, a variety of individuals, diverse people, but also the number of people in the community is greater. And so the community that UNC Charlotte is in is more of an emergent type of community. And then you have the intensive, like the large cities, the New York, where you are near close, or you're in California, LA, one, Atlanta. These are like the massive cities, a high concentration of people. And so when we think about urban education, a lot of people kind of default towards, is it Black and brown, you know? And it's not Black and brown. It's not just Black and brown. It's really based on population. And so what we've seen, at least historically, is that as population has changed, so has urban education, so has the needs of students. And so you, for example, here in Charlotte, there's a flood of people coming into Charlotte, right? And so you have people from all different backgrounds, all different socioeconomic status coming into the city, which is considered a huge like financial staple in the Deep South. And because of that, you have to think about, well, what does this mean for schools? What does this mean for housing? What does it mean for access for families? And so that's when you're starting to see changes of whether it's the teaching population's changed, as the student population has changed. There's a lot of charter schools that are popping up in our community. There's a lot of inventive ways of trying to see how we can meet the needs of diverse student populations. And so that's what I think I've seen initially coming up. Now, I've only been in Charlotte for a couple of years, but I've been able to kind of see some research over time about how just the urbanization of communities has impacted education. And so you see that whatever ill society, whatever society has issue with, it definitely floods into the schoolhouse. And as population changed, so has urban education has changed as well.
So Evan, you know, as you kind of think about this and you and your work at UNC Charlotte, is in an urban education, what are some of the changes that you're seeing in the complexity, the changes at a city like Charlotte, but just the changes overall within our country?
Well, I think one thing that we're seeing, and thank you for having me on as well, one thing that we're seeing is that in general, the public education is becoming more black and brown. And unfortunately, we're seeing the resegregation of education in America, where there's a high population of minority students in these schools. So for instance, in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia City School District is 100% Title I schools. And so seeing that reality is slightly concerning. I think a positive thing that we're seeing, though, is at least there's becoming more, and I gotta be careful how I say positive, but something that is at least happening is people are becoming more concerned about what's going on in our urban schools, for one. And two, I think you're seeing scholarly research programs that are geared towards solving these solutions, solving these problems that we're facing in these schools. And so, you have Gloria Ladson-Billing, who developed culturally relevant pedagogy, or culturally sustaining pedagogy, as it's called currently. And so we have awareness of things that work. It's just not always being implemented. And that's one of the concerns. And by culturally relevant pedagogy, I mean that they're taking into consideration the cultures that students bring with them into the classroom. They are trying to speak to them in a way they understand. And not to say they don't understand proper English, but they want to speak in a way that things they're exposed to normally in their community. Because education is not a one size fits all. You have to consider the student that comes into the classroom. So that's what I would say.
So I want to jump off on that, because Stephanie, I know you have some background in cultural sustained pedagogy and some interest there in your research and in your work. And then Evan, I got another question that kind of hinges on some of that too. Okay. Is how do we get to the places, or as we consider student success and as we consider, and Evan, you brought up the resegregation of schools. We've seen the growth of charter schools over the last 20 years. But now we've seen, kind of the dip in charter school growth, and we see, greater choice, but then we see limited choice in other places. And how do we create more of a system that allows for, you might say, the flourishing of individuals and the flourishing of people within their communities, but then also the education that provides the opportunities and the success that's needed, when you tie it all into this idea of cultural sustained pedagogy and meeting the students where they're at, but then creating the opportunities for them to be successful?
Yeah, so there's two things that I'm kind of hearing. So there's the what can we do from the teacher preparation side, and then there's that big general what can we do as a society. So one thing I think in my research that has stuck out is the way our schools are funded. The taxation system is extremely antiquated in this country. The fact that schools are funded based on local taxes has been the number one contributor of economic disparities within schools. So if you live in a nice neighborhood, you have a nice school. If you live in a low SES neighborhood, your school is not so nice. And so essentially children who are born in a low economic system are essentially punished by going to a school that is ill-equipped, ill-funded, very poor quality in terms of books, outdated books, unsafe conditions, all because of the how much their parents make, And so I think to get to the root cause of what has caused disparities, I think as a country, we need to reevaluate how we're funding schools. As I mentioned to you, Eric, in our other conversations, I read a book by Linda Darling-Hammond that she came out with in 2017 called Empower Educators. And so kind of now as I transition pivot to the teacher side, she talks about the texts and shocks about like what successful school systems are doing around the world. And I must say, given Milner's definition, I would classify all of these cities as urban because they are highly populated cities, very densely populated. She talks about Finland, which we've always heard and seen, but she also talks about Canada and Singapore and Shanghai and Australia as having some of the top educational systems that have not only taught students from all backgrounds, but also have prepared teachers of all backgrounds to teach these students from all backgrounds. And so, and some of the successes that she has pulled out, go into, I think four things really come to mind. One, teacher induction, the way that we are preparing our teachers for the classroom. And a lot of countries, they require that you have a master's degree in your content area. And so you are an expert in your content even before entering the classroom, which then goes into the second area, teacher pay. That a lot of the teachers and all these systems are paid equivalent to the degree in other fields, so they're being paid just as much as a lawyer, just as much as somebody in business or different degrees, so the teachers are getting paid, right? And then culturally relevant pedagogy is being taught in teacher preparation programs as well as in the curriculum, that teachers have more autonomy over how they're teaching a subject and making sure that it makes sense for their students. And then there's also equal and equitable access to education. So wherever, you know, regardless of where a child was born, they have access to a high quality education as someone who was, you know, born in a more wealthy environment. So as you can think about like the trends, there's like, yeah, there's things that we can do at the teacher level, the school level, but we also kind of need to think about like, how are we funding schools and how is that contributing to disparities that we see today?
So Evan, let me ask you the jump off question to there then, because some of your research and some of your work is, you know, is around, you know, Black male outcomes, you know, and all that. And we do know based on the research and based on what even Stephanie points out there is that there is this connection for any student to identify with someone that's similar to them and the success that then they have when they have, whether it's a role model or whether it's the relationship, but there's the connection between, you know, my identity, that person's identity. What can we do, or how do we do this where, you know, we can recruit and retain and develop more teachers that are more reflective of the student bodies in our schools? You know, as you know, some of these schools, like you said, you know, become, you know, more resegregated or Black or brown, or how do we just create a more diverse, you know, teacher population and then prepare them well to be successful?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. One, even before I answer that question, I would say, excuse me, I'm in a place. Hold on real fast. See if I can move.
So Stephanie, as he's moving, as he's adjusting, Jump in there for me too, because that's something that you're working on as well.
Yeah, so I actually had the blessed opportunity to go to the AACTE conference, the American Association for College Teachers of Education. And one of the sessions, and actually she did a deep dive, it was Karen DeMoss from Prepare to Teach. And she talked about, she really kind of addressed, how do we get a more diverse population of educators in the classroom? As we know that our classrooms are becoming more diverse, but historically in our country, approximately around 84-85% of the teachers have been white, middle-class female. And so she mentioned having paid clinical positions for educators and working with school districts and working with other organizations to make sure that we can financially sustain teachers as we're going through their teacher induction and preparation program while they're doing all that, which is, as Darling Hammond pointed out, as I mentioned earlier, is an attribute of a successful system, is that as you are being trained to become a teacher, they are also being paid and you can live on a livable wage. So you're not necessarily stressed out about how am I going to make ends meet while I'm, you know, working, you know, 30 hours a week on my clinicals, you know, to get the certification. So that's definitely one avenue that I think is important when we think about how we diversify the teacher workforce. But it's interesting, because I know we mentioned earlier about like the benefits of, you know, same race teachers, and there has been research to support that Black students who match the race of their teachers have increased educational results. They have also been noted as performing better on standardized tests, They are less likely to drop out of high school. They are more likely to attend a four-year college, according to a Gershon study that he did, and I believe he worked out of Johns Hopkins University. And there was also, Black students experience are less likely to experience discipline disproportionality when they have a same race teacher. And Black males specifically, and I know Evan can speak more to that, is that they've also been cited as being exceptional and incorporating culturally relevant teaching practices in the classroom. But we do know that white teachers can be effective, but we do know that Black teachers are, when it comes to the educational attainment of Black students. And so there's a lot kind of going on from, thinking about like teacher education and how to shore that up, but also how to diversify those that are entering the classroom and how to prepare them well. In addition to, those that are in the classroom that are white middle class, what does it mean for them? There's ways that they can, improve as well to be more effective and more relevant to students of color.
So Evan, add to that.
So, and that's really what I was going to say, what Stephanie pointed to, white teachers can effectively teach Black students. So sometimes not as much about a racial mismatch, which that is something we need to address. But I think at the teacher preparation standpoint, and as teachers are in the classroom, they have to recognize their biases and seek to understand the student. But when it comes to recruiting and retaining, I mean, I think one of the biggest issues when it comes to getting more teachers is the price of education is rising. Right, the price of education is rising, but the teacher pay is not rising. And so we have to find ways to incentivize or to create scholarships at a state level for Black teachers to get into the teacher workforce. So I think that's, to me, that's the biggest thing if you want to talk about recruiting. But then at the same time, even with a racial match, it's not enough to just to recruit Black teachers. We have to make sure that what we're producing is quality teachers. And so we need to also create programs after they finish the undergrad level to help them get master's degrees that are will be helpful for them to be even more productive in their content area. So I think those are two major things. And there are ways to do it. I think it requires policymakers and educators and those over teachers' colleges to find creative ways and creative means, right? Because I was at IQ in the Bahamas, and Dr. Chance Lewis talked about, it was just an idea. It wasn't really a fully fleshed out idea, but an idea that I think is of significance. When you start talking about athletes who go away to college, right? They get a tuition waiver. It's not like someone provides money and pays for what they would have paid. The school literally wipes their waiver away. And so if you can do that for athletes who definitely benefit financially, offer a financial benefit to the college, you could find ways to create these opportunities for Black teachers, both male and female. But I'll say it's important to also get Black male teachers, to recruit Black male teachers into the workforce so that they can go on to be productive teachers.
So, Evan, let me ask you.
Oh, Eric.
Go ahead, Stephanie.
I just wanted to kind of, as we call it in one of course that we took veggie back off of what Eric was saying, is that I think the importance of discussing race and racism when it comes to training and developing teachers, I think, is extremely important. I think that when Cooper came up with a study in 2003 where he talked about how teachers in their development, when they were faced with opportunities to explore their own race, class, and privilege, were actually more effective teachers in the class, just effective in their classroom when it came to working with students that looked different from them. I mean, it resulted in more empathy. They were more interested in learning about the communities where their students were from. And so I think we have to make sure that even interwoven in that, and even with teachers of color, there's a sense of, privilege that teachers of color still have when they enter the classroom that maybe their students may not. Same race or not same race may experience. And so I think when we think about, developing a teacher, I think we can't miss talking about what does race mean and how is that part of how that teacher identity development needs to occur, almost simultaneously as they're learning like content development and pedagogical practices. So I just wanted to make sure to just insert that as well.
No, I think that's incredible, because you know, that's even a little bit of the question I was going to ask Evan, you know, in the follow-up to his comments, but even into those comments is, you know, Evan, maybe even take it down to like the school level. If I'm a school leader and I'm looking to, you know, and I'm in an urban context, mm-hmm. And I'm, whether it's I'm building a school, rebuilding a school, or just, you know, running a school, mm-hmm. and I have all of these demands and I'm going in all of these different directions, but I know in my heart as an educator that, you know what, having a quality teacher in the classroom is the most important thing for those students, is how, and I'm just kind of thinking this out loud as you mentioned a couple things, is how do I create, or how do I find or develop the place where, you know what, this is an environment, this is a school that is not only, you know, that is going to attract you, mm-hmm. Keep you, and then allow us to have the difficult conversations, like Stephanie is mentioning, to really build up a school and be a part of, you know, being a part of that education, and then just solving some of the problems within that community.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying from like a school administrator standpoint?
Yeah, yeah.
I think for a school administrator, if they've been in the school long enough, I think one, you have to view yourself as an advocate, because there'll be teachers, I mean, and let's be honest, especially in an urban context, sometimes the teachers aren't, in many cases, the teachers aren't up to par with the regular educators that go to the more affluent districts. Linda Darlin Hammond in 2010 wrote a book discussing the flat earth in education, or globalization in education. And one of the things she talked about was the fact that educators in public schools are not of the same quality because they are more incentivized to go to richer, more affluent districts for pay. So what I would say is, one, the administrator has to view themselves as an advocate, even though they may have underprepared teachers. And they should themselves, I would say, see themselves as teacher trainers, even though they're not teacher educators currently. They may have a master's degree or an EDD, whatever like that, but they may not, you know, be in the classroom, but they have to see it as, to a certain extent, a classroom where they're training their teachers. Because with school discipline, sometimes educators have sometimes too much authority to send students away for things that could be easily dismissed as a child sucking their teeth. Now the administrator has the potential to say, well, no, that's not a real concern, and then use that as a teaching opportunity to their teacher as to how to handle classroom management, right? Because although, and this is in profession, although we have an education, although we go to school and we have a degree behind our name, sometimes the content knowledge of the course we're learning is hard to put in application. And even though we're hired, we still have to be trained in the midst of being hired. And so I think an educator has seen themselves as not just an administrator with all the demands they have, but also see themselves as a teacher educator from the position in which they serve in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely appreciate what Evan was saying. I think when it comes to what can administrators do, it makes me kind of take a step back to think about connecting pre-service to in-service development. So a lot of times, you know, majority of teachers enter a traditional program and then they do their clinicals and then they, you know, get thrown into a classroom. And so, but there isn't necessarily like a continuum of development or connection between what are they getting in their school where they're teaching versus what did they learn when they were, you know, in a teacher candidate. And so what I'm thinking more so like, how can we create a more seamless way of making that connection? And I'm not sure how administrators can do that, whether they just kind of reach back out to where the universities, where their teachers are coming from. But I'm also thinking too, the development should almost kind of be a continuation of where the university took off. And so, but opportunities for, you know, mentoring for new teachers, I think, is something that administrators can definitely do. I think a lot of in successful school systems, teachers are being mentored for the first like 5 years of their teaching. You know, they're co-teaching. They have with someone for the first year or two, you know, before they're getting out there, just like an apprentice type setup. And also they're planning collaboratively. They're using research in their planning. They are even seeing themselves as researchers, you know, and then not only are they planning with their grade level, but they're playing with their content teams and thereby becoming even more further experts in their field. And then also just thinking about opportunities for advancement. I think when teachers enter the field, I think sometimes, you know, we forget that they may, you know, they're going to improve and get better, and there should be opportunities for them to be advanced, you know, whether and what that title is or what that looks like, of course, has to be school specific. But I feel like a lot of times either teachers can either be a teacher or a department head or a principal or assistant principal. And there has to be kind of some kind of middle ground for teachers to be recognized for their expertise and their years of service without necessarily becoming an administrator. And so with all these in place, you can essentially, you know, create like a teacher type of pipeline, you know, where you're getting teachers for a specific university, you are training them and developing them, they're being mentored by an existing teacher, and then they're planning and collaboratively working, and then the cycle starts all over again with a new teacher, with that teacher that you put all of that professional development in. So hopefully that can be something that administrators can consider when developing teachers.
Right.
So Evan and Stephanie, I mean, we've just even touched on so much of this stuff. Right. So I'm hoping that, you know, we can arrange time where we can go deeper in some of these areas and really kind of dig deep from what you're learning and from what you're grappling with and what you're researching and what you're building in your work to be able to share it with other people. But as we close out our time together for today, give me one thing, right, that as you research or as you work, that gets you really excited for what's coming in the future. Evan, maybe start with you if you got an idea.
I think one thing that gets me interested, because my area of expertise and concern deals most with faith-based schools, is that as school choice is beginning to take its sway with the current administration, and you know, it's coming more and more. There's going to be more opportunity for school choice. That too, the Office of Rights is going to have access to more data, because unfortunately, in our private schools, in our Christian schools, the issue of race is oftentimes not even dealt with, and so we don't even and because it's private, they don't have to we don't have access to. Are we seeing the same problems in public school in our private schools or in our Christian schools? And many of us will say, well, Christian schools, this shouldn't happen. They have good teaching, they have a good moral message. But the reality is for many Black students and many Latino students who've gone through these schools, some of their most racist experiences have been in these spaces. And so for me, what excites me is the opportunity to find the answer. And I think we'll find what many minority students have experienced is that there are issues of race, and there is a need in order for the betterment of Christian education for teachers to go through training, teacher preparation, and have a deeper understanding of the role that race plays in society, so that Black students won't be labeled or targeted and seen as threats, but so that it can really become a premier educational experience for all students of all colors.
Thank you, Evan. Stephanie, how about you?
Well, I think for me, two things come to mind. One, taxation. I think as a country, we need to really address how we are funding schools and how we're funding education, and so that we can allow our country to be a place where all children, regardless of their race, their class, their sexual identity, their socioeconomic status, what job their mom, dad had, what trust fund their grandparents left them, regardless of all of that, that everyone deserves an equal and equitable access to a quality, high quality education. And right. So that's number one. And whatever we need to do to get there, I think that should be number one priority. Second, as it pertains to my field of research, which is teacher preparation, the solution is here. Darling Hammond, as well as many others that came before her in their research, have already outlined what it takes to create a successful education system. All we need to do is just apply it. What does it look like in the United States for teachers to have a paid clinical experience? What does it look like for teachers to be paid as much as, you know, a lawyer or a doctor, given their years of experience, and what would that do? How would that change how, you know, people are coming to education? And one thing I thought that tickled me is that in a lot of successful school systems, there is a waiting list for teachers, you know, in terms of like there's a surplus. What would it look like if the United States has a surplus? One of the most richest and most powerful countries in the world should have a surplus of teachers, right? And so I think about what's out there in the research. I think about what people are doing creatively, like Karen DeMoss and Prepare to Teach. And I say, you look, the solution is here. What's stopping us? And so those are my two final thoughts for today.
Evan, Stephanie, thank you so much. And I hope we can have more of these conversations.
Yeah.
Yes, me too. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you.